Ekatra Podcast Conversations for the Curious Essential Knowledge, Simplified. Your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. Welcome to the Deep Dive. We're here to cut through the clutter and really get to the heart of some transformative ideas. And today, wow, we are plunging into the profound and, let's be honest, often polarizing world of Friedrich Nietzsche, specifically his really groundbreaking work, Beyond Good and Evil.
Yeah, and this isn't just, you know, some dusty old philosophy book. It's a direct challenge, almost an aggressive one, really, to how we, especially in the West, think about right and wrong.
Good and evil, absolutely. Virtue and vice. It's a book that just keeps sparking debate, doesn't it?
It really does. And it's shaped so many thinkers, pushing us to question, well, everything we thought we knew about morality.
And that's exactly why it still feels so relevant today, right?
Totally. I mean, think about it. We're swimming in information. Traditional values are constantly being questioned. People are looking for, like, authentic ways to live. Nietzsche's big question just hits home. How do we get past these simple boxes? You know, good devil, black, white. How do we create new values that actually help humans flourish? So this deep dive, it's kind of a shortcut, a way to get genuinely informed about this massive shift in thinking that's still affecting us now, you know, from personal ethics right through to politics.
Okay, so let's talk about the man himself, Friedrich Wilhelm Nietzsche. Born in Prussia, 1844, and just an intellectual powerhouse from the get-go. It's kind of mind-blowing, isn't it?
It really is.
Youngest ever professor at the University of Basel, 24 years old, in classical philology.
Yeah, and that background, his deep dive into ancient Greek and Roman texts, that's absolutely key. He gave him this incredible historical view, like looking under the hood of how Western values actually got built up over centuries.
What's really interesting, though, is how uniquely suited he was to write this book because he was such an outsider.
Mm-hmm. Explain that a bit.
Well, he deliberately broke from those big systematic philosophers, you know, Kant, Hegel. He wasn't trying to build another grand system.
Right. His style is so different, provocative, these short, punchy statements. Aphorisms, almost poetic sometimes.
Exactly. It makes his work unforgettable. And he wasn't just a philologist or philosopher in the old sense. He was a cultural critic.
He could take things apart and suggest alternatives, which is rare.
And his own life, right? Chronic illness, isolation, his personal struggle with losing faith that gave him this like raw firsthand understanding of living beyond good and evil.
Yeah, it wasn't just abstract theory for him. He lived it.
Yeah.
His earlier book, Thus Spoke Zarathustra, kind of set the stage. But this one, Beyond Good and Evil, is much more direct. It's analytical. It's an assault, really.
So the book itself, what's the core idea beyond that famous title?
Okay, so published 1886, subtitle, Prelude to a Philosophy of the Future. Pretty ambitious.
Uh-huh.
Its main goal is kind of twofold. First, tear down the foundations of traditional Western thought. Just demolish them.
Wow, okay.
And second, to sketch out like a blueprint for a new kind of philosopher, a philosopher for the future.
And how does he tear things down?
He argues that good and evil aren't these absolute truths floating out there. They're human inventions, constructs, rooted in our psychology, our needs, and importantly, in power struggles between different groups.
So not divinely given or universally true.
Not at all, according to Nietzsche.
Mm.
So the book is basically a call to move beyond these simplistic binaries, to embrace something more nuanced, more individual, ultimately a self-created approach to values.
It sounds like a challenging read. It takes you on a journey.
Oh, definitely. It's not comfortable. It forces you to look at your own assumptions hard. It starts by picking apart philosophy's claim to absolute truth. He says, look, a lot of this is just cultural bias dressed up.
Hmm. Prejudices of philosophers, as he calls it in chapter one.
Exactly. Then he brings in this huge concept, the will to power.
Ah, yes, the will to power. Often misunderstood, right?
Very often. It's not just about wanting to dominate people physically. It's this fundamental drive in all life to expand, to overcome obstacles, to grow, to impose its own shape or form onto the world. It's behind creativity, seeking knowledge, everything.
So it's a creative force, too.
Absolutely. And then there's perspectivism, another big one. The idea that there are no absolute facts, only interpretations.
No facts, only interpretations. That's radical.
It is. Every truth we hold is shaped by our perspective, our needs, our will to power. He's really talking to what he calls free spirits.
Who are they?
People who can think for themselves, who can handle uncertainty, who are brave enough to make their own values. The goal, ultimately, is to create better values. Values that actually enhance human potential, not limit it.
Okay, let's dig into some of those chapters you mentioned, because the way he breaks things down is pretty systematic, even if his style isn't.
Right. So, chapter one. On the prejudices of philosophers, he just comes out swinging. He says philosophers claim to be driven by pure reason, but actually, it's unconscious biases, cultural background, personal quirks, psychological needs.
So their grand systems are just reflections of themselves.
Pretty much. He even questions the whole will to truth. Why do we value truth so much? Maybe it serves another purpose. All knowledge is perspectival. It really cuts through any intellectual arrogance, makes you question why anyone claims anything is the truth.
Okay, so if traditional philosophy is biased, what's the alternative? That leads to chapter two.
Exactly. Chapter two, the free spirit. This is his ideal. The person who thinks independently, free from the usual moral chains, the intellectual constraints.
Someone who embraces uncertainty.
Yes, and solitude. Resists the herd mentality. These are the experimenters. They create values. They don't just follow the old ones. He mentions they often wear masks, not to be fake, but to protect their inner world, their unique path, from a society that might not get it.
Interesting. From the individual, he then zooms out, right, to society, religion.
Yeah, chapter three, the religious mood. He looks at religion psychologically, socially, acknowledges it gives comfort, meaning, structure to the masses, can even be a tool for discipline, maybe even for the strong in some ways.
But he's critical, especially Christianity.
Extremely critical. He sees it as the peak example of what he calls slave morality. He argues it celebrates suffering, weakness, self-denial, things he sees as fundamentally anti-life, hostile to human flourishing.
That's definitely one of his most controversial points, a tough pill to swallow for many.
No doubt. But it forces a reevaluation. And this leads directly into the absolute core of the book, I think.
Pooches.
Chapter 5, On the Natural History of Morals. This is where things get really crucial and, yeah, controversial. He lays out his big distinction, master morality versus slave morality.
Okay, break this down. Master morality.
Originates from the strong, the noble, the self-confident. They look at themselves and say, this is good. Power, pride, health, creativity, that's good. Bad is just. What's common, weak, unimpressive. It's more descriptive for them, not this heavy moral condemnation.
And slave morality.
That comes from the weak, the oppressed, the suffering. It's born out of resentment.
Resentment, like resentment.
Exactly. A deep, poisonous resentment of the powerful. So what do? They flip the script. They say, oh,
Yeah.
those powerful people, their strength, their pride, that's evil.
Yeah.
And our qualities, humility, pity, patience, being meek, that's what's truly good. It's an inversion of the master's values.
Wow.
And Nietzsche's big, bold claim is that Western morality, for the last 2,000 years, largely thanks to Christianity and maybe some democratic ideals, has been the triumph of this slave morality.
That is a huge claim about our entire culture.
It absolutely is a massive historical and psychological assertion.
Then in chapter six, we scholars, he makes another distinction, right, between different kinds of thinkers.
Yeah, he separates genuine philosophers, the creators of values, the pathfinders, from mere academics or scholars. He sees scholars often as like narrow specialists, cogs in the machine, collecting facts maybe, but not creating meaning.
Whereas true philosophers,
They are legislators of value. They take risks. They embrace the unknown. They take responsibility for forging new ways of seeing and valuing things. They're charting the course.
so after all this critique, does he offer a positive vision? Where do we go from here?
He does. That comes through strongly in chapter 9. What is noble? This is his picture of human excellence. Nobility isn't about birth or status for Nietzsche. It's about creating your own values and taking full responsibility for your existence.
So independence, creativity.
Yes, and this fascinating idea, the pathos of distance.
The pathos of distance.
It's not just arrogance or looking down on people. It's a kind of inner separation, a psychological space you create between yourself and the herd, the common values and judgments. This distance is what allows for critical thinking, for creating your own path, for forging values instead of just inheriting them. It's about self-mastery.
And throughout the book, there are these short, sharp bursts of insight too, right?
Oh, yeah. Chapter 4, Maxims and Interludes, just packed with them. 127 aphorisms, short, provocative, often paradoxical, designed to just stop you in your tracks and make you think about psychology, truth, women, whatever. Condensed shots of his main ideas.
And he also looks at culture more broadly.
Definitely. Chapter 8, Peoples and Fatherlands. He offers this sweeping critique of European nations at the time. He really dislikes narrow nationalism, sees it as petty, divisive, holding people back.
What's his alternative?
He hopes for good Europeans, people who can rise above national boundaries, who can synthesize the best bits of different cultures, people focused on excellence and creativity, not just, you know, flag waving.
Okay, wow, that's a lot to take in. After going through all that, what are the absolute key messages, the big takeaways from Beyond Good and Evil that really stick with you?
Well, if we boil it down, there are maybe four or five core ideas that, if you really sit with them, can fundamentally change how you see things.
Okay, let's hear them.
First, perspectivism. His attack on absolute truth, basically. No objective facts, only interpretations. Our truths are shaped by our needs, our history, our perspective. The real question isn't just what you believe, but whose perspective does it serve? Does it affirm life or stem from resentment?
That forces some serious self-inflection, doesn't it? Why do I believe what I believe? Are they really my convictions?
Exactly. Number two, master morality versus slave morality. The whole idea that morality is socially constructed. Values aren't eternal. They're human creations from different psychological roots. Slave morality, born of resentment, flips values. It makes you ask. When I look at social movements or political debates today, what's driving them? Is it affirming strength and creation, or is it about tearing down out of resentment? It's a lens for analysis, not necessarily taking sides.
Super relevant for understanding today's world. Okay, what else?
Third, the will to power. That fundamental drive, not just survival, but expansion, overcoming, imposing form. The unsettling part is realizing this drive is behind everything, even our search for truth or love. It's about imposing our interpretation, our form. It challenges any simple idea of pure motives.
So even our highest ideals might be expressions of this deeper will. That's...
Yeah, unsettling is the word. It is. Fourth, the free spirit and self-creation. His ideal, the individual who makes their own values, free from dogma. That's the path to authenticity, to potential. It makes you ask, what would it mean for me to be a free spirit? What assumptions would I need to challenge or discard, not just to rebel, but to affirm myself?
Sounds both incredibly freeing and honestly kind of daunting, that level of responsibility.
It is. And finally, maybe number five, the importance of suffering. He pushes back hard against seeing all discomfort as bad. Challenges, pain, they're necessary for growth, for resilience, for depth. Maybe we shouldn't just try to avoid difficulty, but see it as fuel for self-overcoming.
That really flies in the face of a lot of modern thinking about comfort and happiness.
It absolutely does.
And his writing style, these aphorisms, they make the book so quotable. These lines just stick in your head.
He was a master of the memorable phrase, wasn't he? Here are a few powerful ones. First, he who fights monsters should be careful lest he thereby become a monster. And if thou gaze long into an abyss, the abyss will also gaze into thee.
Oof. That's heavy. What's the core meaning there?
It's a warning, right? Be careful when you confront darkness or evil. You risk becoming like the thing you hate. Stare into the void too long, and it starts to stare back, to change you.
A chilling thought for anyone involved in intense struggles. Need for self-awareness.
Definitely. Then there's the essence of perspectivism. There are no moral phenomena at all, but only a moral interpretation of phenomena. Sometimes summed up as, there are no facts, only interpretations.
So morality isn't in the event, it's purely in how we see the event.
Exactly. It puts the responsibility for creating meaning squarely back on us.
And the famous one.
Ah, yes. What does not destroy me makes me stronger. Probably his most famous line, even if often taken out of context. It's pure self-overcoming. Adversity isn't just bad luck. It's raw material for building strength, resilience, character, if you face it right.
A powerful way to reframe challenges. And one more.
How about this one? What is done out of love always takes place beyond good and evil.
What's he getting at there?
It suggests that actions driven by deep, genuine, affirmative passion, maybe love for a person, an idea, a creation, operate on a different level. They transcend those simple moral rules of right and wrong. It's about abundance, creation, not calculation.
These are deep, abstract ideas. But how do we, you know, actually use them? How can listeners apply this in their own lives?
Great question. Nietzsche gives us some really practical tools, actually. First, personal value clarification. Use his ideas. Ask yourself, what are my definitions of good and bad? Are they really mine? Or just stuff I absorbed? Maybe journal about it. Where did my core beliefs come from? Which ones do I consciously choose to keep?
So it's like actively building your own moral compass, not just inheriting one. That feels like a big act of self-creation itself.
It is. Second, developing intellectual courage. Practice questioning things, especially your own deeply held beliefs. Seek out different views, not to shoot them down, but to really understand. This helps break free from dogma, makes you a more flexible, robust thinker, a free spirit in your mind.
That requires real discipline, though, constantly challenging yourself.
It does. Third, understanding social dynamics. Use that master-slave morality lens. When you see conflicts, social movements, political debates, ask, is this driven by a positive desire to create, to affirm? Or is it driven by resentment, that feeling of grievance, wanting to tear something down? It's a powerful diagnostic tool for understanding motivations without necessarily picking a side.
Incredibly useful for making sense of the noise today. It gets under the surface.
And finally, embracing adversity. Try to reframe challenges, setbacks at work, personal struggles, creative blocks. Don't just see them as bad things to get rid of. See them as opportunities. How can this make me stronger? How can I grow by overcoming this? Use the struggle itself.
Okay, wrapping up then. For me, after this dive into beyond good and evil, what really hit home was that idea of responsibility. The responsibility to create our own values. It's liberating. Sure, we're not just stuck with old rules, but wow, it's also this huge weight, this burden of choice. You have to actively decide what matters. Consciously steer your own moral ship. That's ongoing work.
Yeah, that's a great point. For me, what really stands out is the psychological angle, the unmasking of what's behind beliefs. I find now I can't really hear a strong moral claim without thinking, okay, what psychological need is this meeting? What will to power is being expressed here? Is this coming from strength or from resentment? It turns you into a kind of amateur philosopher psychologist. Changes how you listen to everything.
So the final thought for you, the listener. If beyond good and evil suggests our most cherished truths are ultimately human creations, what new truth, what new values are you willing to create for yourself and maybe even for the world around you?
See you next time with another remarkable thinker. Another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Akatra Foundation.